Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Taking his cue from the Naples garbage crisis, Pope Benedict urges the faithful to cleanse the trash from our consciences and souls by turning to the power and light of Jesus to show us the right path. A Pilgrim's Progress. In the run-up to this weekend's papal visit to the great Spanish pilgrimage city of Santiago de Compostela, we find out more from a British pilgrim who has been on the walk there several times. And ditching drugs. Pope Benedict is dedicating his prayer intentions this month to the victims of drug abuse. And we listen to compelling testimony from a former heroin addict who managed to kick his addiction. Taking his cue from the Naples garbage crisis, Pope Benedict urged the faithful to cleanse the trash from our consciences and souls. Addressing pilgrims at his Wednesday audience, the Pope said the trash is not just in the streets, and we need to let Jesus into our consciences so they are illuminated and cleansed. Emma McCarthy tells us more.
There is trash on the streets of the world, says Pope Benedict, but also in many souls. Let us allow the words, life, and light of Christ into our consciences so they may be illuminated and cleansed. This is the lesson that he traced from the life and work of Marguerite Douin, the French Carthusian nun whose life spanned the 13th and 14th centuries, to 7,000 people present in the Paul VI Hall for the Wednesday audience.
Marguerite's writings, which includes her earliest known examples of Provençal French, were inspired by the evangelical spirituality of St. Bruno. They reveal her fine sensibility and her deep desire for God.
In fact, little is known of the early life of the reclusive nun, apart from what is revealed in her writings, known as the Meditations.
Marguerite viewed life as a path of perfection, leading to complete configuration to Christ, above all in the contemplation of his saving passion. She imagines the Lord's life, his words and his actions as a book which he holds out to us, a book to be studied and imprinted on our hearts and lives until the day we read it from within in the contemplation of the Blessed Trinity.
The Holy Father continued that Marguerite's writings radiate a warm love of God and deep gratitude for his grace, which, said Pope Benedict, purifies our affections and draws us more closely to him. The life and writings of Marguerite Douin invite us to meditate daily on the mystery of God's infinite love, revealed above all in the sufferings of Christ on the cross, and to find in this the strength and joy to place our lives at his service and that of our brothers and sisters. Finally, in his greeting to English-speaking pilgrims, Pope Benedict had a special welcome for a group from Pittsburgh.
I'm especially pleased to greet the delegation from the Anti-Defamation League, as well as the representatives of Pittsburgh's Jewish and Catholic communities. I invoke the Almighty's abundant blessings of grace and peace.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Pope Benedict travels to northern Spain this weekend for a two-day pastoral visit that takes him first to the pilgrimage city of Santiago de Compostela and then to Barcelona, where he will preside over the consecration of the Holy Family Cathedral. Tradition holds that the remains of the Apostle St. James the Greater are buried in Santiago de Compostela, and the northwestern city has been an important pilgrimage destination since the Middle Ages. The Pope's visit there this weekend coincides with the Santiago de Compostela Holy Year, which occurs every time St. James's feast day, July the 25th, falls on a Sunday. William Bossert is an architect in London who has been on the pilgrimage walk to Santiago several times. He spoke to Lydia O'Kane about why this pilgrimage is so special for him.
Well, it's been for me a historical sort of and cultural draw initially, because I, after a stage in my life where I got a bit more time to do things that are good for the mind and for the body, and I look to the pilgrimage as an answer to combine a lot of different things. It looked like a very big challenge to tackle, and I felt that is the sort of thing which we don't often have an opportunity to do, and the pilgrimage seemed to be an answer to that sort of need I felt within me, yes.
A spiritual need, you mean?
The spiritual part is an important part. It's a very holistic thing. In the life we lead normally, we don't often have these sort of big challenges which bring us as a complete person to the limit of what our existence in a way. It's spiritually and sort of daily life sort of challenge, if you like.
I want you, William, just to describe your experience of actually being on a route towards Santiago. Perhaps you could be our eyes and our ears and take us through that.
Well, the biggest experience, the biggest discovery I made was that the moment I started the pilgrimage, an immense sense of freedom and happiness descended on me, which is something I just never experienced elsewhere. And it comes from the feeling that all the senses get touched by being on a route with other people who somehow have got a similar destination. And the feelings which make it so rewarding are the combination of the nature around you, the scents of flowers, the birdsong, and the villages you're walking through, several hundred years of history of pilgrims walking through. And that is something which you just sense and which gives you feeling of connection to a community that has done the same thing over a number of centuries. I'm also, as an architect, I come through towns and villages which have greeted the pilgrims over many hundred years, and the buildings and the churches and the community facilities are all geared to make the pilgrim welcome, and there is a feeling of fitting into sort of a human community that has done this journey as long as Christianity existed almost. So it's a humble experience as well as a huge level of freedom you experience.
I wanted to ask you about the Holy Year. Is there a difference in doing the pilgrimage in a Holy Year?
It's, to me, just a stronger focus on what the pilgrimage is about. I've walked the different routes in different years.
Would you say, are there more people? Are people more inclined to do it? And do you feel is there a different atmosphere, or do you find that it is the same?
Naturally, there are far more people doing it, and it's a busier sort of time in the refuges. And I think these days it's very much a greater pressure, really, on the route. I wonder whether the spiritual part of the Holy Year does come through In the same way as when there is less pressure on the route. So I do not really see a huge difference spiritually in a holy year, because it's a fantastic spiritual opening whenever you are actually doing it. So I think the holy year is a big focus for everyone to actually consider doing the route, and it brings more people to the route to experience what can be experienced whenever you do the Camino.
When you get to the actual cathedral, the end of your route, when you actually go towards your goal, you've been traveling all this time and you're walking towards the actual cathedral, is it a sense of you've reached the pinnacle, or do you kind of feel there's an anticlimax? What did you feel? What was your experience of that?
It's a fantastic feeling of exaltation. It's a huge achievement to have walked all these weeks and days towards Santiago. When I reached it, it was the experience, a huge downpour. It was so dramatic to enter the cathedral square as a pilgrim with dripping from wet and soaked, and to enter the cathedral doors, which it was a marvelous sort of huge sheltering space and magnificent, like sort of arriving at the point of light. And to share that with other pilgrims, to join in the Mass at that point, was a high point in my life one can't ever forget. It also is the end of an experience, but it's a fantastic experience. You can't compare with anything else I've ever sort of experienced. It is, after a few weeks of exertion, a liberation, and achieve a goal.
What do you think about the Pope coming to Santiago de Compostela?
I think this is a wonderful thing for the Camino and for the Pope to do. The pilgrimage is something very fundamental for individuals, and by doing the pilgrimage in his way, every person who does it experiences and contributes something important to their life and to the tradition and to the history of the pilgrimage. It is a big gift which everyone can receive, to be able to walk through history on a path that has been walked by millions of pilgrims. The Pope's visit, in my view, is wonderful in supporting and extending that tradition. And I'm very grateful and happy that he is carrying on to bless the route and the people who do that. A marvellous thing.
That was William Bossert talking to Lydia O'Kane about his pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela.
They were dark times indeed. And on some occasions, I remember getting down on my hands and knees, because even though I was completely consumed by drugs at that time, I remember getting down on my hands and knees and tears coursing down my face, asking God to take it away from me. I was in my own hell.
Jerry Adams is a former drug addict from the English city of Bristol, who was describing there the desperation he felt during his addiction to hard drugs. Adams has now kicked his habit and runs shelters for people recovering from alcohol and drug addictions, and for those who are homeless. A sad story with a happy ending. But there are millions of other people worldwide who remain the victims of drug abuse or other substances. And this month of November, Pope Benedict is dedicating his prayer intentions especially to all those struggling with addictions. Although concrete figures are hard to come by, some newspaper reports say that Britain has got the highest levels of drug addiction in Europe. Another British man, who like Adams, has been through his own personal hell of drug addiction, is Kerry Norwich from Oxford, who became a heroin addict by the time he was 20. He was only able to kick his addiction after 14 years and found help in rehabilitating himself into society at the Cardinal Hume Centre in London, set up by the late cardinal of that name to help homeless and marginalised young people. Norwich is now doing a drama course to become an actor and was chosen as one of the speakers at the prayer vigil in London's Hyde Park that was attended by Pope Benedict during his visit to Britain. Norwich says that through this gesture, he hoped to dispel some of the stigma that is attached to addicts, even those like him who are ex-addicts and who are trying to rebuild their lives. But what's it really like to be addicted to heroin? To find out more, I began by asking Norwich what first prompted him to start experimenting with drugs as a teenager.
Well, there were no real obvious difficulties, either at home or school or in my private life. Certainly at that time, drugs were fairly prevalent, and it was quite common amongst my peers for people to start using drugs of some sort. Even the harder drugs, as heroin, became fairly common use amongst certainly my peer group. So much so, in fact, I remember at the time there was a national newspaper run a story, I come from a little village, and the story focused on this village and the headline being Heroin Haven. So there was quite an influx of drugs, so it just almost became the norm.
But presumably you started off first by smoking cannabis, and well, how quickly did you then get into hard drugs like heroin? Was it quite a speedy process?
Yeah, that's right. I did start off smoking cannabis. It's referred to often as a gateway drug. Indeed, that was the case with me as well. Around about 16, 17, started smoking cannabis, and then that progressed into what you could term recreational drugs, but it was associated with socializing and enjoying myself. And quite a leap to hard drugs, say, an addiction to heroin. I heard sort of scare stories that, you know, this is a dangerous drug and people get addicted. But I had that view that, it wouldn't happen to me, that I'd be immune. That wasn't the case. And very quickly, I got addicted to it. Probably within a month or two of first using smoking heroin, I had a physical dependency on it.
And how did you feel at that stage about yourself when you knew by then that you were an addict? Were you sort of constantly trying to get out of it, or were you in denial?
Denial did play a part sort of later on regarding how bad and desperate the situation was getting. But very, very early on, I was consciously trying to get off of drugs and get out of that world. But its grip was too great on me. I was addicted for 14 years. And pretty much over that entire time, it was a constant battle trying to quit, but not succeeding.
What was the reaction of your family when they realised that you were a drug addict? Did they try to help you? Were they shocked? What was their reaction?
Yeah, I remember very clearly the time when I told them. They certainly were shocked and, you know, very upset. Any parent want their child to be going through and destroying themselves and their lives in front of them. It's a very difficult time, and they've done their best to help over many years trying to help me out of that, but it's almost impossible for anyone else to solve the problem of a drug addict and get them off of drugs. It has to come from the person themselves.
How much of an impact did it have on your education? You said you were about 17, 18 when you started sliding down that slippery path.
Well, education was certainly one area where it had a massive impact. At the time when I first started taking heroin, I was at college, and very quickly it stopped me from being able to turn up to class. I dropped out in the second year, and it just made it impossible, really, to carry on with the education and with with life in general. I mean, that was the same story regarding all aspects, employment as well. I'd have all the good intentions of working, trying to stop using the drugs, but it would always win the day, and I would lose jobs. I'd get kicked off of courses.
Now, of course, buying drugs is quite expensive, even though the price has gone down in recent years. How did you manage to get enough money to feed your drug habit? Did you ever have to resort to theft or some other kind of criminal activity to get your fix?
Well, in the earlier years, I was employed, basically. I'd get jobs to support my habit. Though as time went on, those jobs, I'd hold them down for less and less time. And so, yeah, toward the latter part of my drug addiction, I'd resort to different methods to get money. Predominantly at the very end, the situation I found myself in was homeless on the street. So, I mean, once or twice, there are desperate situations where I had to raise some money. And so, yeah, I resorted to some petty theft. But I quickly realized that I was no good at it. So, yeah, I found other ways to go about it. Initially turned to begging, which, and again, I found very quickly I wasn't too good at.
As a drug addict, I mean, how often were you having to get yourself a fix, you know, to not have any sort of abstinence crisis?
Oh, it would be daily. I mean, I'd need to buy and use drugs daily, and often more than once daily. I mean, it would be a whole pursuit. The entire day would really be geared around raising the money, buying and using the drug, or went on drugs. So I wouldn't eat very well, wouldn't sleep very well, and that all had a massive impact on my physical health. And subsequently, the emotional health, it was very bad. Depression played a massive part. Through the isolation that I felt, I just felt very hopeless, lonely, just really not connected to anyone.
So what made you decide in the end to take the very difficult step to really try to kick your habit? Was there any one particular incident or one day where you woke up and said, this is it?
Yeah, there certainly was one incident I can point to where there was a definite change. When I was living in a homeless hostel, I managed to get myself out of sleeping rough and got into a homeless hostel where I stayed for over 3 years. And one evening in there, a chap just came up to me and started talking with me. And basically, he was an ex-drug addict, and at that point had managed to get himself clean. And he could see me and the situation that I was in. He could identify completely, and he knew where I was at and what was going on for me. And so he just basically let me know that it didn't have to be like that, and there was something that I could do about it. So that really was the turning point for me.
Okay, so I gather you managed to kick your habit, and then after that, you went to the Cardinal Hume Centre, didn't you, that helps homeless and marginalised people, including, of course, those with substance abuse problems. How valuable and useful was the help they gave you there to try to rebuild your life and help you to stay clean and away from drugs?
Yeah, the help they gave me really was amazing. And without that, I mean, goodness knows where I'd be now, really, and how well I'd have coped. Fortunately, I managed to kick the habit up till today. It's been 2.5 years, and hopefully I'll have many, many more. I was 6 months clean when I moved into the Cardinal Hume Centre, straight out of rehab. And I was very, very fragile and vulnerable. It'd been many, many years being on the fringes and sort of self-harming, really. And I was faced with this massive prospect of trying to build a new life, almost starting from scratch, having to sort of learn the basics again, to look after myself, to cook, to get into a routine and structure. And then, of course, what on earth to do with my life? Lots and lots of questions that I couldn't really answer. I didn't know how to go about it. So it was just a godsend to find myself at the Cardinal Hume Centre and feel safe and have access to the support that they have, namely a drugs worker to help with any issues directly relating to my sobriety and abstinence. And then there's an employment and training and education team that helped me access a college course that I started a year and a half ago and helped me with the funding for that also. And a general support worker and IT suite to help with some basic IT training. So really invaluable support.
Now, you were one of the young people who spoke at London's Hyde Park at the prayer vigil during Pope Benedict's visit to Britain. How was that experience for you, and what message were you trying to get across?
Oh, it was an amazing experience, truly amazing. Just the atmosphere and energy that was in the park then was incredible. With so many people, I think it was 80,000 people, just really connected. And when I was speaking alongside the other couple of people, we were really listened to, and it was just incredible and felt very loving. You could just feel the love, basically. It was fantastic. The message that I wanted to really get across, it was twofold, really. Firstly, for the person that is suffering with addiction, and just to be able to put out a message, like I heard from that chap when I was in the homeless hostel, that it is possible to quit drugs, get out of the clutch of addiction, and change, and go on to have a happy, fulfilled life. The hope that I got from that really allowed me to find the courage and the willingness to change. So any opportunity for me to be able to give that message out, so hopefully someone somewhere can hear it and gain strength from that, well, then that's just an honour for me. And also in recognition, the Catholic community and Cardinal Hume Centre in particular, to really say thanks for the great support that is on offer out there. And looking back, when I got into the drugs, if you'd have asked me then why I was doing what I was doing, I'd probably tell you because I enjoyed it. That would be my response then. Now looking back, really I can see that it was more to do with, I kind of had an internal void. And that internal void, I sort of see that now as really being a spiritual void. I was very lost. And that made me weak and susceptible, really, to the comfort that drugs gave me. And so today that's been the thing that's really helped me beat it.
You talked about how you've beaten drugs. If you had to sum up in just a sentence or two how much better your life is now as somebody who is clean, who is no longer the prey of drug abuse, how would you describe it? What are the best things about it?
Oh, wow. My life is so, so different. Today I've got choice. I can choose what I want to do. My life isn't governed by this insane need to do something, and to do something that's so damaging. And I can stay in education and not be kicked out, and in fact do very well. And I'm finding that I've sort of had talents that I didn't really know existed. Also, actually, another really major change regarding relationships. Being on drugs and living that way just affected my relationships so badly. I wasn't able to really make new friendships, build friendships. And ultimately, my family also, that relationship broke down as well. The pain and hurt that I'd caused. Today, I can make and keep and build new friendships and really appreciate them. And also the relationship with my family, I have the chance to build those bridges again and think of them and not just myself as I used to. I used to live a very selfish existence. So now I can think of others and be a son and an uncle and be involved.
I was speaking to Kerry Norwich from London about his past experience as a heroin addict. That's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we hope you have enjoyed listening to us. We'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, you can always find our programmes at the click of a mouse on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.